Welcome to this week's edition of A Degree of Interest with me, Monique Chambers, and my guest this week is Dr. Rachel Radmelli. Now, you've got a really interesting doctorate, I have to say. Can you tell us a bit about it?
So, yes, I do tend to get this reaction quite often. So, first of all, thank you very much for the invitation to the programme, Monique. It is quite an interesting point of discussion. So I get a lot of curious remarks regarding my PhD research because I actually, the short version of this is that I actually researched the wine industry. And people automatically assume that that's, you know, involved a certain degree of consumption of wine.
And it didn't?
Not as much as I would have liked to, admittedly. But basically, the longer version of this is that I actually read for a degree with the Free University in Amsterdam. Okay. My doctorate over the last several years in the anthropology of organizations.
Okay.
So my interests, I do have an interest in food, and I'll explain that later on. But in actual fact, what I was looking at were the various companies and organizations which are involved in the production of wine. And I had the chance also to look back at the history of wine production on the islands, which really goes back quite far. So it was more of an academic interest than an interest in the actual production of wine. So I'm not an expert, you could say, on the actual science of winemaking, but more interested in the way organizations work in particular social contexts to produce something that is considered a traditional product. To see, you know, the various waves where, for example, there were times when wine was always doing well, other times when wine kind of took a bit of a plunge in reputation, and how contemporary smaller companies, for example, are really working hard to overcome the past, you know, bad reputation to start producing some boutique wines of considerable quality.
So once you decided you want to do this subject, which I'd love to know how you came up with the idea in the first place, and then you found a university in Amsterdam to work with, again, you don't think of Amsterdam and wine, so I'm guessing that's more about the organisational aspect of things.
Absolutely.
Then where does your research go once it's become your PhD? What has happened to it since you completed it?
In a way, it's kind of broadened out to a broader interest in the anthropology of food. So there's a lot of anthropology of over here coming in, anthropology of organizations, anthropology of food, which is another way of saying that we can take a sort of focused look at very specific aspects of social life.
Okay.
So whether it's the world of business, the world of work, or the world of food, and my particular interest was a combination of both. Starting off from the fact that I am interested in food research, the broader aspect of food research, especially the cultural aspect of food research, looking at cultural foods, where I had even in the past studied, for example, traditional Maltese bakeries for one of my undergrad degrees.
Oh, hello!
So, exactly, I had to spend a certain amount of time, poor me, you know, sort of, in some really fantastic bakeries in Orme. People know that Orme is very famous for its bakeries on the island. And it was a chance to start looking at these small businesses, you know, which are working with such traditional products. And then wine made for a very interesting, you know, follow-up to this.
Well, bread and wine.
Bread and wine, you know, essential, you know, both on a spiritual level and even on a, you know, social and consumption level.
So what did your research find? What did it teach you? What did it tell you that from the local organizations producing wines?
One thing I think, which the one takeaway really is that a lot of the wine being produced at the moment is really the product of a few strong individuals who really have a passion for what they do. They just love producing their wine. They're, you know, very dynamic about it. And as I always keep saying to several friends, it's all about the stories behind the wine. It's not just the wine itself, but the way we enjoy wine is a total social phenomenon in a sense. You know, it's about consuming wine with friends. It's consuming wine in a meal. It's about, you know, seeing how each individual company or each individual estate, you could say, has set up their own history, their own tradition in a sense of producing it something that's both new and also something that plugs into this idea of a Mediterranean tradition, a Mediterranean history that's got this Mediterranean flair. So even going back to a point that you asked me earlier on, where does my research go from here? It does broaden out to something which can really help us explore how society works. By looking at food, food traditions, by looking at the way food is produced or the way food is consumed, tells us a lot about who we are. And there are several entities around the university which are working on this kind of research.
Okay, so what other entities? So if we've done bread and we've done wine, what else is going on that we can perhaps get involved in? No, and what else is actually going on university?
Yes, on the university level, there are things actually that the public has usually been invited to.
Okay.
Obviously, the pandemic has given us a bit of a break in this respect, but there are various events that we like to organise. And by we, I mean the Platform for Mediterranean Foodways.
Okay.
Which is a cluster of academics who are interested in different aspects of food-related research. The chairperson is actually Professor Charles Kassar, who, as many know, is a historian with a very particular interest in food. He takes a very anthropological flair to this as well. And we have other people even coming from a science background, like Professor Everaldo Attard, for example, from Earth Sciences, who has done a lot of research on the genetics of local produce, for example, agricultural produce, whether it's the olive tree, whether it's honey and bees, or even the local produce cheeselets, for instance. And many other people who are coming in perhaps from an education perspective or even from a nutrition perspective as well. So there are all these people coming together with this one common interest, which is food, and the way food places itself in society, and what we can learn by the way people are.
Is there any sort of labs and kitchens at the university where you get together and make stuff and do stuff and research stuff, or is it all you have to go out because it's obviously quite a small place?
There are the more science-based colleagues would have their own labs. They're actually exploring stuff and stuff, but it's not really something which would be open to the public, I'd imagine. However, we do normally, as the Platform for Mediterranean Foodways, organise a couple of seminars and events that the public are normally invited to. Obviously, when they're held in person, we do normally cater a certain amount of food and wine to be enjoyed as well. It's not just about the talk, it's also about, you know, sort of walking the walk, so to speak. However, thanks to the pandemic, we've sort of for now focused a little bit on webinars. And in fact, we do plan to organize a webinar in spring.
Okay. Where,
so people watch the space so that we can eventually, start promoting these webinars, which usually take on a very particular theme that is very local, something of interest. Say, for instance, one of the things we're looking at the moment is the idea of promoting local agriculture. A past webinar dealt with the idea of food waste, for example. We took bread as the central theme, where three different speakers spoke about bread in different ways and how nowadays bread has gone from something being staple to something that we, you know, easily throw away, kind of.
Well, my nana used to make bread pudding.
Exactly.
Pudina, I think.
Pudina, yes, yeah. That's right.
From any bread that happened to be left. I don't know how it ever was left, but...
But it's true. I mean, this is the thing. I mean, in the past, people were so careful with what they throw away. You know, people weren't as wasteful as we are now. Days. We might call them frugal, but in actual fact, they were very creative because there were so many different recipes. It wasn't just the pudina, but even, for example, people would use breadcrumbs, for example, to coat their meat or whatever it could be. You know, so stale bread had a use. It had a purpose.
Ah, of course.
It was never thrown away.
And today we just buy breadcrumbs, which...
The thing is, we consider bread to be a cheap product nowadays. So there's this whole perception aspect that comes into the way we look at food, where it's so easily available and yet so disposable.
Mm. But with wines, Maltese wines are kind of coming up the ranks. I know you're saying you're more about a production expert. Mm-hmm. Do all of the wineries in Malta produce their wines in the same way? Do they use the same grapes? Is there a difference in how they do things? Is that
the technique itself doesn't really vary much. And in fact, the actual technique for producing wine hasn't changed much over the last 7,000 years, really,
okay,
of production. There have only been a few changes, namely refrigeration techniques, which help keep the wine at a constant temperature, and maybe a little bit of scientific knowledge to know why wine goes bad. But otherwise, nothing much has changed. So the technique itself is quite similar, but each winery has its own terroir, so to speak. So the differences come out either because of the person themselves, who has each person has an own story to tell, or even, for example, the idea of the different locations, where each location would have a particular soil, it would have a particular climate.
Even somewhere as small as Malta.
Even somewhere as small as Malta. So if one estate, for example, is close to the sea, you might get an element of salinity coming into the wine. So for those of very discerning palate, might actually taste a very small hint of saltiness in the wine. and even, for example, places like Puglia that, mm-hmm. you know, many of us love visiting kind of thing, you would have certain wineries right on the coast, which in actual fact would pick up this minerality from, you know, the sea kind of thing. Whereas others, which are more inland, say there are certain wineries, for example, in the center of the island, like Attard, or the Sidjiwi valleys, for instance, those are more agricultural areas. So they would have a different type of soil. There might be more water available. So that would affect the way the grapes mature. And each winery tends to use, in Malta, I'm saying, each winery does tend to use its own varieties of grapes.
Ah, so it's not one across the whole island?
No, and this is where Malta differs from other countries like Italy and France, for example, where each region in Italy, for example, would have a particular grape that they use. And that is also something which is controlled by the standards which are issued by the European Union, for instance.
So that's all those, they have those DOCs and DOPs and all of those.
Exactly, where the DOC and the IGT comes in.
Do we have anything like that in Malta?
We do. Okay. We do. And this was something that came about after our joining the EU. So there is always a political dimension as well to winemaking, basically. And that allowed for, you know, the different agricultural policies to cater for this idea of wines of a certain standard, quality wines. I mean, the quality isn't something which can really be dictated. It can't be defined of wine. It's something very subjective. You know, the wine I enjoy might not be the wine you enjoy. And some people find it very difficult to choose wines because they believe it's expensive, it must be good. And it's not always the case. Mm. Some people might enjoy a medium-priced wine more than they might enjoy a very expensive wine. It's all down to taste. However, there are certain clues as to which wines should promise, you know, a pleasurable experience, shall we say. And usually when you have these standards, which are, you know, carefully controlled, and they control the amount of grapes that go into a bottle, the level of alcohol that comes out of the, you know, grapes themselves, that would give a measure of standard, basically, which people can use to make their choices.
Okay, because I remember years ago when I used to come to Malta on holiday, the wine wasn't very palatable. It was never something you wanted to sneak back in your suitcase. Whereas now it is something you actually give to Italians.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
as a gift, yes. Which is quite something that's become quite something to be proud of. How has that happened in such a relatively short space of time?
It really all boils down to the raw materials. The Italians would call it the materia prima. Mm-hmm. And it's only in the last 20 or 30 years, really, that grapes have been grown again in Malta. And that makes a very, very big difference. Having the vineyards locally means two things. First of all, you're capturing the terroir, you're capturing the climate, the soil, and that contributes to the flavors. And secondly, it means at the moment the grapes are harvested, they go straight to the winery itself to start the fermentation process immediately within sometimes minutes, you know, wow. Or at most hours.
Okay.
Whereas before, many of the companies, even the large companies, who sometimes still find they're battling these past reputations, used to depend basically on the importation of grapes. They had no other choice at the time. Mm. Because of certain restrictions that there were and competition with different industries. So that contributed to a poorer quality wine. In some cases, they still produce these what we call nowadays table wines, and they're used, you know, for cooking or
teenagers,
exactly, or you know, sort of even, you know, maybe some people just want a cheap wine; they don't want to spend much on the wine.
Need to mix it with 7-Up.
We don't exactly no longer. Yeah. But even some of the larger companies, it's not just the boutique companies, but the larger companies are also, you know, competing with this idea of the boutique aspect. They're producing large numbers of bottles of wine, but they're also focusing on their estate wines as well. It's not just the small boutique companies, kind of, which are doing this.
Okay, so is there enough wine to go round for Malta? If we didn't import wine, if something horrible happened, would there be enough wine produced in Malta to keep us all going?
Possibly not.
Okay.
Possibly not, okay. Because in actual fact, the amount of wine that the small companies produce is considered to be a very, very small amount, to the point where you can almost consider it a rare wine.
Okay.
You know, when companies are producing less than 20 or 30,000 bottles of wine per annum, it's, you know, quite a small amount of wine. The larger companies obviously produce more than that. They produce a couple of million. But when you consider, you know, tourism is usually quite high under normal circumstances, obviously, pre-COVID and now hopefully post-COVID as well, then it'll be very difficult to cater for local demand.
If you've just joined, you're listening to me, Monique Chambers, with my guest this week, Dr. Rachel Radmelli, talking about wine and other things here on A Degree of Interest. So you just said that some of the wine producers produce millions of bottles of wine. That's incredible.
It is incredible, but they also produce several different labels.
Okay.
So it's not just millions of one particular type of wine. They used to produce much more. They used to produce possibly 2.5 times as much as this. But now they're focusing on the quality wines as well, seeing that this is what, you know, the market wants. People are becoming more discerning. People are traveling more. People are more experienced in asking for, you know, the good things in life. And people are learning how to appreciate the good things in life as well. It's not just about a cheap bottle of Plonk. It's about, you know, producing something that, you know, we're investing in our enjoyment. We're investing in, you know, enjoying these local products as well. So prices have gone up, but they're also, you know, investing more of their energy in these particular quality wines.
I think one of the things I've noticed is actually the packaging itself, because I'm a packaging freak, and the design and the packaging actually really does make you want to have that wine on your table or, you know, in your cabinet. It's the beauty of local wine is really quite something in terms of its packaging. Is that something you see across the board? Because they didn't have any legacy, really.
That's really interesting, actually. That's a very big question. In actual fact, one of the particularities about wine is when you buy a bottle of wine at the supermarket, you can't really taste it before you actually buy it and you've paid for it, and you can't quite return a bottle of wine. I'm talking about the supermarket here. We're not all, you know, a place where you go and buy a bottle of wine, not a restaurant. So in actual fact, what you're buying is what you're seeing, what you're reading. So you're using most of the senses, but you're not quite tasting the wine. So yes, many of the companies have invested in different designs for their bottles. And it's not only the information on the back, but we're often attracted to particular labels, some of which can actually be quite collectible. And I mentioned earlier that some of these wines are quite new, but they're trying to plug into this idea of history and heritage. So when you see, for instance, the names of their varieties of wine, if you were to take, if I can mention, for example, Meridiana, one of the first boutique wineries that started off in the 90s, they use this idea of the Phoenician legacies, you know, the Phoenician gods, the idea of the Meridiana, the sign, where, you know, the sundial kind of thing, is, you know, play on words, a play on themes, to try and, you know, sort of bring in this idea of history, when in actual fact it's a very young company. And there were other companies which are much younger than that, but they're also portraying this idea of a connection with art, a connection with history, a connection with heritage, to add a layer of authenticity to their work.
That's it. There really are some quite special labels. So seeing how many companies there are already, is there room for more people to set up wineries in Malta? Because I'm seeing there's a big, like a craft beer thing happening in Gozo and now in Malta. Is there room for more grapes to be grown, more wine?
There always
produced?
Is, as long as we have the land to be able to produce the grapes. And for now, I believe there still is enough land for that. There's always the element of, you know, competition for use of space. Malta's small. But for now, I do think that there is space for people to be able to cultivate their own vineyards. It is, though, a lot of work. Maybe one thing which people are underestimating, say, oh, you know, set up a winery, there's not much to do. You just, you know, press the grapes in September and that's it. But in actual fact, these very dedicated winemakers spend hours every single day working in their vineyards. So the wine is being produced from, you know, day one of the year. It's not really something which, you know, you plant the vines and then just wait for them to mature kind of thing.
That's exactly. Even that, the planting of the vines, it can take years for anything decent to come off them, no? It's
what we're lucky about is that in Malta, being so warm, the vines mature much faster.
Oh, okay.
So usually after 3-4 years, they can start, you know, producing some decent wine. So with very young vines, obviously the more mature the vine is, with limits there as well, the more people can, you know, start producing their wine. Whereas abroad, it would take twice as long.
Ah. And with the local wines that are produced, do they generally produce to match Mediterranean food or our local food? I'm just sort of assuming that, you know, when you grow something next to something, it all kind of goes together. So does our local wines match our local food, or are they made to match any kind of food?
I don't think they're made to match anything in particular. They are really just products of the environment in which they're produced. So then it would, in a way, happen naturally that if there's food produced locally, then it would be equally beneficial, you know, and for the person. In fact, even there's been some scientific research which shows that the more you're consuming local food, the better it is for the person. Because, for example, they're
pastitsi.
That's locally produced food, that's locally processed food, possibly made with imported flour. No disrespect to pastitsi, you know, I mean, they're quite a staple and there's quite a national sense of identity there coming in, okay? So, But if you would consider, for example, tomatoes or fruit, you know, we often speak about, you hear people saying that, you know, local fruit, locally produced tomatoes, or locally grown rather than produced tomatoes or fruit, are very often ugly to look at, but much, much tastier than the fruit and vegetables which are imported. Mm. And there's also, and then, an added bonus in that very often these agricultural products, and even wine is an agricultural product at the end of the day, are still subjected to the same environment stresses that we are subject to as people living on the island. So the immune system, or the immune benefits produced by these fruits and vegetables, which we are then consuming, is much better for us from a health perspective as well.
So we should all be drinking local Maltese wine.
Drinking local Maltese wine and eating locally produced or locally grown fruits and vegetables. Okay. Ugly as they may be, they're probably better for our...
Well, the plus is you have peas in them, to be fair.
And hopefully locally produced cheese as well. So that's
yes, absolutely. Too. No Maltese cheese.
Yes.
Yeah. But that's not the thing here really much. You've got the Trebbiano, but there aren't many other varieties of cheese, or is that something?
There are some of the small companies which are experimenting with different forms of cheese. There's a lovely little, if I can make a little bit of a shout out here, a farm in Zabut, for example, which are really promoting their sheep's milk products.
Ah, okay.
And they're experimenting with different forms of cheese, for example, or products as well, including ice cream.
Ooh.
So they actually make really good ice cream. They make a lot of ricotta products from sheep's milk.
And this makes it then lactose-free?
It's not lactose-free, no, but the proteins would be different.
Okay.
So people who have a dairy intolerance would then be able to digest, you know, because really and truly dairy is only a relatively recent introduction in the Maltese diet. It's only been maybe 200 years that we've been really cultivating cows in Malta.
And so you've studied, obviously, the production of wine. There's other food things you can study here at the university. Can you tell us a bit more about the anthropology section and anthropology of food that perhaps people, if they're interested, can find out a bit more about?
Yes. Once a year we're on a course, which is usually in the first semester, called the Anthropology of Food.
Ah, okay.
Plain and simple. And it was launched this year for the first year, first time. And it looks at various aspects of consumption and production, not only in Malta, but around the world. And the idea being that, as I said, when we look at the way people are producing food or the way people are consuming food, and even what type of food they're producing and consuming, we learn a lot about the way a particular society works and the way that particular society exists within a global context as well. So we're looking at connections as well between the local and the global, between consumption and production, and between tradition and modernity as well. So all these various dichotomies come together when we look at, you know, food itself. Not only in terms of the science of food, but more in terms of the, you know, anthropology of food, really.
Because Malta, you know, almost a quarter of our population are foreigners. There's 100,000 people here that aren't Maltese. And I'm noticing as well my friends that are in their 30s are becoming more and more interested in the things that their nana had produced and then Nana ate. So this is quite a nice segue into, you know, our own anthropology of food in reality, that we're being able to have our young people and young people moving into Malta being introduced to Maltese food as it was and as it should be.
This idea of nostalgia comes in to food a great deal. You know, when you think about food, we need to think of it in terms of the way it manages to stimulate all the senses. It's not just about taste, it's about the smells, it's about the sights, it's about also the memories that come with food and the association that comes with food, the way we, you know, food can be used to include people or even to exclude people, you know, if people, and even nowadays when we see, for example, intolerances, for example, but even before there would be certain exclusions based on religion, for example, if certain religions eat certain foods, other people don't eat certain foods. So, this idea of the generations, you know, and the way we try and recreate some of the past recipes that were handed down, you know, there's this connection with the past, which, you know, really elicits so many emotions, so many feelings.
So just to pretty much wrap up the show, what's your favourite food memory or your favourite food that brings back nice memories? Well, it could be a worst food, actually, that brings back memories. It could be completely the other way.
It's difficult to think about worst foods, I think. Somehow all foods seem to have... But I think in terms of memories, it's not a particular food, but more a particular activity where I remember my, you know, maternal grandparents always cooking in the kitchen when I was younger, being the eldest granddaughter on both sides of the family, actually.
Okay.
I always seem to remember my grandmother's cooking. They were always cooking, 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 like there's no tomorrow, you know, sort of thing. And they had certain routines, which I think are quite enviable nowadays. I wonder sometimes if that was their secret to a long life, you know, in most cases a long and healthy life, that they always had a routine. They had a very particular pace, you know, a particular balance in life.
Not buying frozen things from the supermarket.
Absolutely never buying frozen things from the supermarket. You know, they always used to buy their fresh bread every day, and, you know, they had their vegetable people coming over.
And this pot of tomato soup.
Yes. Going on at a slow pace, you know, the idea of time, it was a completely different pace, I think.
So maybe we should be focusing a bit more on our own food.
On taking the time to produce our food, to cook our food, and to enjoy our food.
Absolutely. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. We should have had some wine, though.
I agree.
I feel that was missing, but maybe next time. Thank you for joining me on this week's A Degree of Interest, Dr. Rachel Abmeli.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.